This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Look in any basic astronomy textbook and you can read about Copernicus, who discovered that the Earth revolves around the sun. But wait, there is a problem here because many of today's historians will tell you that Copernicus probably didn't figure this out all by himself. Some of the research behind his discovery came from the Islamic world. That's just one example of our topic this hour, the ancient history of science outside of Europe. Dick Teresi, one of our guests, has written a book called Lost Discoveries. It's a sort of a world tour of ancient science history. He describes how people in China, India, Egypt, and other parts of the non-Western world grappled with the fundamental questions of science and math. Also joining us this hour are two historians of science to talk about how they view the early history of science and how they try to interpret scientific records that are thousands of years old. So if you would like to join in our discussion, please, you're welcome. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Science writer Dick Teresi is the author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from the Babylonians to the Maya. You might remember him writing his previous book, The God Particle, which he co-wrote with Leon Lederman. He joins us from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hi. Dr. Jamil Rajep is the historian of Islamic science. He's a professor of history of science and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Dr. Rudyard Hart studies the history of Chinese mathematics. He's assistant professor in the Department of History and Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And we find him today in Chicago at WBEZ. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Dick, let's start off. I mentioned Copernicus. Let's start with him. Why is it that some folks think he may have borrowed some of his ideas from Islamic researchers?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that he did, and Dr. Rajep, I'm sure, is one of the foremost researchers on that topic. The main problem with the Ptolemaic system, besides having the Earth as the center, is that the math was all wrong, and he had these sort of crazy epicycles. And Islamic scholars spent centuries trying to correct that. And they required two new theorems, one the Al-Tusi theorem and the other the Ur-Dilemma. And these show up in Copernicus's work. And they did it centuries before Copernicus. We find no proofs that Copernicus left behind. In fact, it was Kepler, Johannes Kepler, when he was constructing his three planetary laws, who remarked that Copernicus had not offered any proof of these two theorems. He wondered where they came from. He didn't see them in Euclid, and he didn't see them in Ptolemy, and it's pretty clear now that it came from the Islamic world.
Dr. Rajep, you have studied this period of Islamic science around the time of Copernicus. Is there more to the story, and how much information did Islam and Europe share?
Well, it's a very good question, and Mr. Teresi has given what we might call the view that there is definitely a connection here, and in fact we can say that many of the theorems are similar and so forth, and the approach was similar. But in addition, we can look at this problem from a different angle, from the question of whether the Earth moves or not. And recent research has shown that, in fact, there is some indication that Copernicus took the whole idea of a rotating Earth and from Islamic discussions. In other words, that there had been some earlier discussions about this that lasted two or three centuries. And Copernicus was probably influenced by that as well. So the interactions go deeper than we've previously thought.
What were the Islamic astronomers, if I could call them? What were they basing their ideas on? Watching things in coming from outer space?
Well, actually, it was a criticism of Ptolemy. Ptolemy had maintained in the Almagest that, there was a very clear proof that the Earth was at rest. Namely, if you throw something up in the air, it comes straight down. And what Islamic astronomers noted and built on it as a criticism was that, in fact, there could be other explanations. If you threw something in the air, it could be carried along for some reason by a force, by the air itself. In other words, there are reasons or ways in which you can explain how something could be carried along with a rotating Earth. These are the kinds of arguments and discussions that we think reached Copernicus.
And, Dick, you're saying that Copernicus may have been aware of these or read about these discussions?
Well, not only been aware, but it's just not – these ideas aren't unique to the Islamic and the European world. As early as 800 B.C. in the Rig Veda, the Indian religious text, there's the assumption that the universe is held together with what they called attraction, which we might call gravitation. And the Indians had a heliocentric solar system as early as 400 A.D. They did not have an inverse square law, as Newton came up with, but they were quite clear on how the solar system worked. And as a matter of fact, go ahead.
No, so it's possible to come up with these ideas independently.
Oh, absolutely.
By and not having, but not getting a whole bunch of publicity for it.
Well, I am sure they got publicity in their own lands, just right. Not in ours.
Yeah.
This whole concept of everything came from ancient Greece and then science died for 1,000 years, only to be Xeroxed, as it were, by the Islamic medieval world, is just not true. And no one really believed this until, say, mid-19th century. Prior to that, Europeans were much more in love with Egypt and Phoenicia as the cradle of civilization.
Roger Hart, there were similar exchanges between cultures and Chinese math, your area of expertise.
Yes, and in fact, I work on the introduction of Euclid's Elements into 17th century China. And one of the things that the historiography or previous historical accounts have always asserted is that Chinese mathematics was in decline and almost lost during the 17th century. When one actually looks at the historical records, one finds an enormous amount of Chinese mathematics, and some of it very, very complex. And there seems to have been a fair amount of circulation between various cultures, but tracking down exactly how that circulation worked, of course, with the very limited texts that we have from any culture is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we know now that the Chinese invented movable type way before Gutenberg did.
Yes.
And they
yes,
invented paper way before people in the West did.
Yes.
As did Korea.
And the compass and all these other kinds of things that we never, you know, are taught in the early textbooks. Are the textbooks changing now a bit to reflect some of these things?
Slowly. One of the problems or one of the things that I'm very excited about this book is that the academic research into the history of world sciences has not really reached a broader audience. And so I think that one thing that Mr. Tracy deserves to be congratulated for is writing an excellent book that really does that.
Mm-hmm. Jamil, let me ask you, why is it if with all these great traditions in Islamic science and mathematics, very little of those of the credit arrives today with them?
Well, it's a very loaded question. I think, you know, part of the reason is that the original historiography, the historians who wrote about the relation between Islam and Europe, was tainted by late 19th century views that tended to differentiate between quote-unquote Semitic peoples versus Indo-European peoples. And many of the writers of the late 19th, early 20th centuries tended to say things like, well, you know, the Arabs just preserved the Greek text. They didn't really add anything to them. They were custodians, but nothing else. And it's taken a while for that view to change. It is changing. With Professor Hart, I would say that books like Mr. Tracy's books are an important mechanism for this change to occur. The places where I publish usually are read by a lot of people, but this will probably get a wider audience. And this is the way in which change really does occur.
I think it's interesting, Dick, that you didn't start out to write this kind of book, did you?
No, I believed in the old theory. I was taught the old theory that there nothing happened before 600 BC until the pre-Socratic philosophers came along, and that nothing happened after the fall of ancient Greece until the Renaissance. And when multicultural education was in vogue during the late 80s, I went out to sort of criticize multicultural science education because some of it that was being taught was awful, such as the Egyptians had gliders and the Sumerians had batteries and the Incans flew over the Nazca Plains in hot air balloons. So I was all prepared to make fun of it, but then I thought, you know, to be honest, I wanted to see if there was some legitimate non-European science, and 6 years later I ended up with this book and never wrote the article.
Was it easy to find evidence?
Yeah. Oh, amazingly so. People like Professor Hart and Rajab, they should be household names, as Otto Neugebauer and David Pingree and many other incredible researchers in this area. For some reason, they haven't come to the popular front. And as much as, say, Jacob Bronowski and Carl Sagan and others who teach a very pro-Western philosophy excluding non-Europe, the non-European cultures.
Mm-hmm. Dick Teresi's book, Jamil and Roger, he compares all of those non-Western discoveries to what Europeans were doing. Is this the way historians approach their research?
Well, I can just add one thing about Carl Sagan's Cosmos book, just as a comparison. There's a chart that shows a blank spot in a timeline between 500 and 1500, which is the time that I study. It is completely blank. And there's the thing that this represents a poignant lost opportunity for the human species. Well, you know, he used to talk like that. That's what the common view, I think, has been. And it was reinforced, in the 80s, 70s and 80s, by Bronowski and Sagan and others. So this has been, this marks an important change, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so also. What this really is a science and civilization approach to the history of science. And Joseph Needham, who was the greatest historian of Chinese science, articulated this very clearly. What he wanted to do is to assign credit properly to each civilization for the discoveries that they had made. And he called this a grand titration, so giving credit not just to the West but to China, etc. I think that this approach is an approach that was very common in especially the early 20th century, but I think that more recently we have turned more to what we call microhistories, where we look very closely at science in context rather than a macro history that compares civilizations. And I think that this change is a very good one.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short break. We're talking about ancient science outside of the Western world with Dick Teresi, science writer, author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from Babylonians to the Maya. Jamil Rajep, a professor of history of science and coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. Roger Hart, assistant professor in the Departments of History and Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. As I say, a short break. Stay with us. We'll come back. Lots of phone calls. We'll get some of yours. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about ancient scientific knowledge, discoveries, mathematics that were outside of European purview, before even European discoveries, with my guest, Dr. Jamil Rajep, professor of history of science and coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, Dr. Roger Hart, assistant professor in the Departments of History and Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and Dick Terese, science writer and author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from the Babylonians to the Maya. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. Let's see if we can go to the phones, because lots of people want to talk about it. Let's take a simple question from Norm in St. Paul. Hi, Norm.
Yes, I have about three questions.
One
of which is, what did the ancient Greeks, I mean, they were renowned for being very good in mathematics, but what did they use for a number system? I mean, we're all familiar with the Roman numeral system, and was the Roman numeral system based upon the Greeks? And question two is, I'm very much interested in the history of our own number system. I know that the number zero was invented by, or reputedly anyways, invented by a Hindu mathematician, and I'm going to guess a little bit and say 34th century, and it was incorporated in with the Arabic numeral system that we use today. And fourthly, you know, a lot of this seems to tie in with the hatred on the part of Arab Islamists toward the West, and Thomas Friedman called that cognitive dissidence. In other words, there was a time when the Arabic civilization, shortly after the founding of Islam, was preeminent when Europe basically went to sleep. And now the roles have reversed again, and so that seems to contribute to a certain amount of animosity, where if you have a culture in which you believe that possession of religious truth and the highest form of monotheism should equate to preeminence and dominance in the scientific spheres and business, economics, military, and so on.
All right, let's get some answers to some of those questions. Let me ask Rajep, but Jamil Rajep, what do you think? Want to pick any one of those?
Okay, let me start with the number systems. Very interesting question. The Greeks used multiple number systems. One that they inherited from the Phoenicians, in fact, where letters stood for numbers, so alpha was 1, beta 2, gamma 3, etc. It wasn't a very efficient system. There were other counting systems similar to Roman numerals that were also used. But the Greeks in later times, after the Hellenistic age, when Alexander had made his conquests, this brought peoples of the Eastern Mediterranean into much closer contact. And it was then that the Greeks, at least in for their scientific work, adopted the Babylonian sexagesimal system, the base 60 system, place value system, which is sort of the granddaddy of all of our current place value systems. And he's quite right that that eventually the base 10 system of the Indians has come to predominate, but by way of Islam, which added the decimal fractions to that system. So it's a complicated story, but one that shows how many cultures contributed to the way in which we just write numbers today.
Dennis Overby of the New York Times also wrote about point number three. In an article about the preeminent system of the Islamic culture and what happened to it. How come we don't have, you know, that kind of the evidence of that kind of influence today?
Why doesn't the Islamic world have is no longer preeminent, you're asking? Well, you know, there are probably a variety of reasons. I think an easy answer, but one I don't particularly agree with, is that it's just a result of the religious fanatics coming to power. I think what is a better explanation is that Europe took a certain turn after the 16th century that led it onto very productive into a very productive path in scientific discovery. The Islamic world has been slow in catching up, so to speak, and in modern times it's mostly because not a great deal of money is put into scientific research, and this in some ways has to do with political reasons, in some cases because certain countries, for example, Saudi Arabia, has been reluctant to embrace what one would call the scientific culture of the West.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dick Teresi, how big a role does religion play in the history of science and science and math and cultures? There are a lot of great Western scientists. You can name Isaac Newton, for example, who were very religious people. He did great science. But in your book, you talk about other religious other ways that religion was influential in pushing science.
Well, our common conceit today is that science has advanced in the West because we've separated it from religion. I don't think that's totally true. And in the past, you saw them intertwined as twin arms for finding the truth. I mean, for example, the creation myths of Mesopotamia and the Babylonians included such things as the Venus tablets of King Amezadaga, which had, centuries of sightings of Venus and allowed them to forecast lunar eclipses. Math advanced greatly due to religion. For example, the Vedic text, Hindu Vedic text, the Silva Sutras, means rules of the chord, because chords were used in geometry for measuring. And in order to, there were specific directions in the Silva Sutras for constructing sacrificial altars in which they sacrifice soma, the narcotic drink and foods. And if you wanted to double your square altar at home, for example, you couldn't just double the lengths of the sides because that doesn't work. You have to use the diagonal, and that means you have to figure out the square root of 2. And so they had to figure out square roots. And I'm sure Mr. Rajep can tell you about Islamic inheritance laws. Very complicated, the wife's 1/4 goes to the daughter, some percentage goes to the sons, etc. That required algebra that had not yet been developed and was developed in the service of religion. And, of course, the Egyptian the pyramids are all astronomically and mathematically situated.
Mm-hmm.
If I could just...
Yes, Dr. Rajep, go ahead.
It might surprise your listeners to know that trigonometry, is, as we know it today, is probably the result of Islamic religious ritual, finding the direction of prayer to Mecca. The five daily prayers, which are astronomically determined, require very sophisticated spherical trigonometry. And although there were elements before, the chord tables of the Greeks, the sine function of the Indians, this was brought to a much higher stage of development in Islam because of these religious imperatives.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's take a phone call. And Mike in Ithaca, New York. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there? Mike?
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
All right, yep.
You sound like that cell phone commercial.
No, it's a speaker phone, but I live in a swamp, so even the landline works.
Go ahead.
The speaker phone works better than the other one on this condition. Oh. Sorry.
Okay.
Hi, Dr. Rajep and Dr. Teresi. What I wanted to talk about was basically two things. One was that the kin theory, which is the basis of sociobiology today, exactly corresponds to the law of karma in Vedic philosophy, and I can defend this avidly. But the main thing I'm trying to call about right now was, as you probably know, the Pythagorean trituples, that is, triples of numbers like 3, 4, 5, or 11, 60, 61, which can be the sides of right triangles, that the Babylonians had a tablet called the Plinton Tablet, which had these trituples on it, and Otto Neugebauer and others have always said that the way they calculated that was if you have two integers that don't equal each other, and let's say J is the bigger one and I is the little one, the sides of the triangle are 2ij, j squared minus I squared, and j squared plus I squared. And I came up with another way that they might have done it, and I'd like to share it with you guys and the audience, but there isn't enough time, so I want to give out my email address.
I'll tell you what, you send it to us at Science Friday, we'll put it on our website.
What's the address?
Just sciencefriday.com. We'll put it on our website, okay?
Okay, I'll do that as soon as you're off the air and as soon as I can get my computer up. I have to go out.
I hope it's not solar-powered.
It's quite cold. As soon as I get the temperature up and the computer can run, I will.
All right, Mike, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. What about crossing over the ocean to the Mayan, to South America, Central America, Mayan cultures or whatever? How they were there to developing things on their own, Dick?
Well, we assume they developed on their own outside of extraterrestrial visitations, which is a popular theory, but not with me. Yes, they had a zero about the same time as the Indians developed zero, somewhere around 200 A.D. They had a place value mathematical system. And they were obsessed with big numbers, as were the Indians. Mm-hmm. They were obsessed with running out of time. And so they loved making these large numbers and these having various interconnected calendars so that they would never run out of time. And the Indians also were, you know, fascinated with large numbers, which is, I think, one reason the zero was so popular with them, because it's so easy to make big numbers. But I find what's interesting is that the Science Magazine, which is the official publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in its January 2000 issue, listed 96, the most important 96 scientific discoveries. And the only two that went to non-European civilizations were the zero of the Mayans and the Indians, and the Mayans' work with astronomy around 1000 A.D. Hmm. But clearly there was a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rajib, Iraq, of course, Baghdad, is located in what was once a Mesopotamia, and it was home to one of the world's first great civilizations. Are there still science or math texts there that might be damaged if the U.S. goes to war with Iraq?
Well, that's a possibility. In the last round, if we can call it that, in 91, there was some slight damage, but since then, some of my colleagues who work in Mesopotamian culture tell me that there is actually a lot of looting that has gone on. The Iraqis, because of the embargo, you know, have taken to just digging things up and selling them on the world antiquities market. So there's been a lot of damage or loss, if you will, because of that, and that's probably going to continue for the foreseeable future. And, of course, if there is a war and, you know, if there are massive ground troops fighting, you know, a lot could be lost. Someone has once said that Iraq is one giant archaeological site. The whole country is just covered with tablets and temples and what have you. So, you know, there could be a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about ancient science history this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Could there be lots of untranslated, you know, you say it's a giant archaeological sites. Could there be lots of places around the Middle East that are just waiting, you know, to be dug up
Well, some of the stuff has been dug up, mm-hmm. and they're in libraries. Just there's no one to read them.
Is that right?
It's been estimated that under 5% of all Islamic scientific texts have been read or looked at. Much fewer have ever been published. We know very little about this tradition. It's shockingly little. For example, the connection with Copernicus is only about 30 or 40 years old. In other words, our knowledge mm-hmm. of that connection is quite recent. The thing that I was telling you about, the connection with the rotation of the Earth and Copernicus, that's only been published in the last year or two.
Hmm. And why so little of it being read?
Well, again, a good question. There are very few people who, I guess, have the stomach to go through all the training involved. I mean, it takes a lot of work to learn Arabic in the first place if you're a European or American. The second thing, even if you learn modern Arabic, it's still difficult to deal with scientific texts, mm-hmm. medieval scientific texts. And then people in the Arab world itself, and in Iran and Turkey, have not really done a good job of developing what we might call an infrastructure of historians to deal with these materials. Perhaps some of the same reasons that there is not a strong scientific tradition in these countries.
Mm-hmm. So you don't hold out much hope then for...
Well, there's always hope. There's always hope, and you know,
is there money to finance it in the Islamic world if someone could do it?
Well, there have been attempts. There is an institute in Aleppo in Syria that's about 30 years old now. The Saudis have put some money into this as well, but in a country like Egypt, for example. The older, tradition of learning that developed in the 30s and 40s, where there were people studying these things, has not really grown or flourished in the past half century. One country that is trying very hard is Iran, surprisingly, and Iran has quite a number of people who are and institutes that are trying to preserve this heritage and do something about it. But again, it's going to take a massive effort.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk with Dick Teresi, Jamil Rajep, and Roger Hart about ancient science and take your phone calls. So don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Contributors also include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology and to portray the lives of men and women engaged in scientific and technological pursuit. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Dibner Fund, encouraging the understanding of science and technology in our lives, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Denzel Washington has directed his first movie about a man who overcomes his anger.
He'll be laying his hands on you, or he may have a book in there that may have the answers to all your problems and all your questions. Ain't that right?
Today, we'll review Antoine Fisher and talk to the man who inspired it.
Kids can grow up and be angry, and people might not know why they're angry.
Meet Antoine Fisher on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about early science history from non-European cultures with my guests, Dr. Roger Hart, Assistant Professor in the Department of History and Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, Dr. Jamil Rajep, Professor of History of Science and Coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Dick Teresi, science writer and author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from the Babylonians to the Maya. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Before we get to the phones, Dick, you don't talk much about biology or medicine in your book, but one area you do mention in that regard is the Amazonian rainforest and their traditional medicines, some of which are being studied today by Western medicine. How did they find medicines that work? Did they just go out and randomly poke through the forest looking for medicines? How did they know? That's a science. You know, it's research.
Well, it's I stayed away from that area pretty much because I find it's such a nebulous area, biology and medicine, and also a large area. It does take on a kind of a mystical quality. You know, Schultes is one of the modern researchers of that subject. Which what plants do what to you, to your body? And there's a lot of shamanism, becoming, as it were, the plants themselves, going into trances. And we're not sure how they came up with it, but they came up with antibiotics. The Inca were the first to process cocaine. And evidently, there wasn't a great deal of addiction. They used it for pain relief and other purposes. They seemed to know what was toxic. They, you know, poison arrows had a paralytic on them.
Right.
They knew how much to use that would be anesthetic before it would kill you. They seemed to have a very sophisticated knowledge of it. Now, part of that reason is that they had a different set of ethics than we have today. One of the reasons that the Aztec, for example, were way ahead of Europe of the same period in their knowledge of anatomy and circulation was that they did 10,000-20,000 human sacrifices per year on their enemies and had incredible obsidian scalpels that some surgeons in the U.S. now use. And so they would cut people apart. Whereas in Europe, that was kind of frowned upon. And Europe had to deal with the autopsy theaters in order to find out anatomy, which was much more limited than having 10,000-20,000 human victims at your disposal.
Roger Hart, the Chinese are very well known for their herbal medicines, acupuncture, and all kinds of stuff.
Yes, they did a considerable amount of work on medicine, on pharmacology, things like that, and stuff that to some extent is still used today, as you know, acupuncture, some of the Chinese herbs and medicines, etc.
Was there a tradition in China of passing on this knowledge?
Traditions. Yes. Well, many traditions, many different competing schools, different social statuses, different kinds of educational backgrounds, etc.
Dick Teresi writes about a school of philosophy in China called the Mohist School, if I pronounced it correctly.
Yes, you did.
And
yes, that's a very interesting example. And again, I wanted to compliment Mr. Teresi on doing a very nice exposition of that. Chinese work on optics. Unfortunately, this work was one of the works that, with the demise of the school of the Mohists, the work became essentially lost until the great philologists of the Qing dynasty went and reconstructed it in their interests in reconstructing early texts. But there is work in there that seems by present modern-day standards on optics to be very good, and there's also some very interesting passages that Mr. Teresi outlined about certain postulates about the universe, about space, time, etc. And a very interesting part of the book.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can let's go to the phones. Joan in Los Angeles. Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi there.
I would like to know, where does Africa fit into the science, this ancient science that you guys are speaking of?
All right. I'll see if any of our guests can answer that question. Dick, any?
Well, Africa is more problematic, and I assume your listener is referring to sub-Saharan Africa, because obviously Egypt, there's no doubt that Egypt were masters of mathematics and many other things. The kingdoms of Kush, et cetera, North mm-hmm. Africa, were great metallurgists. But we have really yet to unravel the full story of Southern Africa, and to many ways, we really don't know much about Mesoamerica and South America yet either. We're just learning just that the Olmecs, for example, their recent discoveries that the Olmecs of the Yucatan, precursors to the Maya, had a written language and may have had a place value system in mathematics as early as 1400 BC.
Did the British colonists of Africa have no interest in digging up artifacts or learning more about their history? I would think that.
Well, I think it's been a blind spot for sure.
Yeah. Sorry, Joan. Are you there? Sorry, I can't answer that question. But you would think that if these other cultures independently of each other had developed their own ways of searching for knowledge, that would have happened in Africa also.
Sometimes. Well, yes, and we do see evidence on fossils of number systems. You see very interesting mathematical work in music, just as Professor Hart has shown in mm-hmm. Chinese civilization and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Professor Rajib and Hart to talk about alchemy. I mean, we hear, ancient Europeans talking about alchemy. Was it practiced in the Islamic and the Chinese world, and did it lead to modern chemistry at all?
Let me just say something briefly about that. There were different traditions in Islam. There was the Jaberian tradition, the Jaber ibn Hayyan tradition. Tended to be a bit more mystical in its approaches. But there were also some, what we might call, hard-nosed empiricists, such as Al-Razi and others. And I think that there is compelling evidence that the ways in which a variety of techniques and substances were examined did have an effect upon Europe. We know many of these texts were translated into Europe, and in fact, people even claimed they were Arabic texts when they weren't Arabic texts. So it did have a profound influence on Europe.
Roger Hart?
Yes, China, of course, also has a very long tradition of alchemy. Nathan Sivan wrote an excellent book in which he researched and translated parts of a famous alchemy text. And it's been argued, and I think it's possibly the case, that interest in alchemy is what led to the Chinese discovery of gunpowder and their later creation of firearms, etc. So alchemy is something of considerable importance in the Chinese tradition also.
Mm-hmm. I once interviewed a gentleman named Elliot Sivowitz at the Smithsonian. He was once the curator of electricity there. And I had been looking at my own research to try to find who is the first to do anything. And he said, the harder you look at the first, you always find the third, who turns out to be the second, and the first is never found to do anything. Dick, right. I understand from reading your book you came across the same conclusions, possibly, about trying to nail down who is the first to do anything in any of these places.
Well, yeah, you can go crazy doing this. But one thing I was convinced is that it's rare that the first are who you were taught in high school. For example, we're talking about alchemy. Lavoisier, around the time of the French Revolution, came up with the whole idea that revolutionized chemistry by putting on a weight basis, quantitative basis. You know, two hydrogens and oxygen make water, etc. That it's not magical. It's and reduce quality to quantity. But the Chinese were doing this in 1000 BC. The Indians were doing it. The Islamic world was doing, where they broke down qualitative things into quantitative things. You know, it's two units of this, four units of that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about ancient science this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's see if we have a little bit of time. Let's see how many more phone calls we can get in. Let's go to John in Miami. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
How's the weather today in Miami?
Not bad. It might going to be rain a little bit.
Yeah, eat my heart out.
Yeah. I have some comments. One of them is about the Islamic world, why we don't see this, so many Islamic, you know, the ancient scientists' name. I believe because of belief system, and I think they believe that everything created by the God, and that means in that case Allah. So the people just discover and whatever the Allah created, so they don't need to put their name on that. And second of all, I'm a Turkish American, and I would like to mention that you can find a lot of Turkish scientists, actually, we better say, in aeronautical worlds, particularly flying from one side of the Bosphorus to another one with the wings, and a person named Hazarfen Çelebi. The other one is the Lager Hasan. He used the today's rocket things, and he even lifted himself off from the ground. Mm-hmm. And these are the, and also we should mention several medical things that they discovered, particularly the vaccines that they discovered, the vaccine systems before even Dr. Jenner discovered. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rajep, you want to comment?
Well, I think that people did put their names to texts, and in fact, I'm talking about Islamic scientists, and in fact, sometimes they're very protective of this. There are some texts or writers who accuse other people of plagiarism, so clearly, academic rivalry was alive and well in the Islamic world in the Middle Ages, as it has been in many cultures. As far as the medical tradition with vaccines and so forth, what we do know, El-Razi, for example, was one person who investigated measles and smallpox and differentiated between them. There some of the other things, though, about flying and so forth, I'm not quite so sure about that. I don't know. Mr. Tracy, do you have any comments about that? That sounds like an apocryphal story to me.
Yeah, I think that's up there with the Sumerian batteries and the hot air balloons, yeah.
Okay, thanks for calling, John. 1-800-989-8255. There is that story of the batteries. Tell it briefly, and you mentioned finding these copper objects that, for all intents and purposes, look like batteries.
Sumerian copper pots from the 3rd millennium B.C., and if you put the different kinds of vinegar and oils in them, General Electric, they did a study that you could, get a couple volts out of it. The problem for me is that, fine, but exactly what were they powering, you know? We have the problem in this country is you have toys with no batteries, and I guess they had the problem of batteries with no toys to cook them up to. So
you're saying they couldn't be
awful
batteries?
Bit of a stretch.
It couldn't be batteries because we didn't find the toys.
That's right.
Well, maybe the toys just didn't last as long as they.
Just the batteries.
But wouldn't they want you to?
That would be a switch.
I mean, if they were batteries, wouldn't you want to be looking for something that they could have powered?
Well, I would. Yeah. I would. Sure. You know, and as far as the Egyptian airplanes, one would wonder why they needed the chariots and the other gear that they used.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to stop this discussion, pick it up some other time in the future. It's been delightful. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Jamil Rajep, historian of Islamic science, professor of history of science, and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Science writer Dick Teresi, the author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from the Babylonians to the Maya. Really interesting read if you like anything at all, like I am reading about the history of this. It's very interesting. And it'll change your views about where science started. Thank you, Dick, for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Roger Hart, historian of Chinese mathematics. Dr. Hart is an assistant professor in the Department of History and Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Matt Galick. And Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Leski and Alphonse Vinn. surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. If we talked about the links and whatever that we mentioned on Science Friday. If you missed them, you can find them up there in sciencefriday.com. And you can send us email and download old versions of Science Friday. Stay with us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Support for NPR comes from Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, educating Americans on the issues of affordable electricity from coal and a cleaner environment. BalancedEnergy.org. The Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the Sugar Association, educating consumers about sugar. Sugar, the natural sweetener. 15 calories per teaspoon, on the web at sugar.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After 9/11 and anthrax and the sniper, none of us wants to be too far from the news. I'm Neil Conan. Talk of the Nation might focus on politics or history or an important new novel, but we're always ready to follow a breaking story in depth. That's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.